Hello and welcome to Why Is This Happening with me, your host, Chris Hayes. Well, it's the dog days of summer. We're patching together a staff here at With Pod and All In because we've had some departures and then we've got vacations. So we're kind of catch as catch can. But a special thing is happening today. It's been a long time coming. We have not had a mailbag where we get to hear from you, the listeners, in a long time. And more importantly, we haven't heard from our great producer, Tiffany Champion, in a long time. In fact, Tiffany Champion, who will still be working on WithPod, we're about to get a new staffer on WithPod, which is very exciting. You'll learn more about this individual in the upcoming weeks. But we thought it would be a good time for a little summer mailbag with the one and only Tiffany Champion. So, Tiffany, how you doing?
My triumphant return.
Yay. How's your post-vac summer going?
Post-vac summer has been great. I got to go home to Chicago for a little bit. I didn't see my family since Christmas of 2019. So I did like a bit. Yeah, we were supposed to go back Christmas of 2020, and then Illinois, where I'm from, the numbers were just absolutely catastrophic.
Yeah, they got really bad.
So we canceled our plans at the very last second, which a lot of people did. We stayed home. So it was like 16, 17 months since I had seen my family. Got to go home, have one of those like picturesque reunions that everybody's had. It was great. So
it's the only upside is that for you is that you're not close to your parents and they don't love you a ton. So it's a super chill scene.
It's great because, yeah, we're so estranged.
That's a joke because Tiffany is very close to her parents and they're like the most adorable human beings on the planet. And they love her so much and are so proud of her. So I can only imagine how much it was breaking their heart to be away from you.
Can I tell you something extremely cringe and then we'll absolutely get into the mailbag?
Oh yeah, definitely. Your dad can bring the cringe.
This is a Tiffany dad combo cringe situation. In that last year I asked my dad for his birthday in June what he wanted. And he said, I want nothing. I want a promise that you'll be home for Christmas. And so I typed up a fake legal document.
Oh my God, that's so cute. It's like when you're seven and you give them like good for one back rub or whatever.
Literally, yes, that's exactly it. And I made two copies. I mailed one to him, included a self-addressed return envelope saying that I would return. And so he had kept that as proof, bearing witness that I would be home for the holidays.
This is so cute.
I still have mine. So we're those people. So yes, it's been great. Looking forward to seeing more friends and family this hot back summer. And getting into our WithPod mailbag. It has been a long time. It's been a long time since we dug into this. And
really
a lot has happened.
Yes. Yeah. was the last mailbag before like the pandemic? Probably,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
My God.
The before times.
Jesus.
So we have a lot of ground to cover. And here's how I'm going to preface this. As Chris said, we've been extremely understaffed on All In. We have big changes coming to the podcast.
Changes that you'll like expansion
changes that you will
changes.
Like. We're all so excited.
Yeah, very excited.
Yeah. But that means that this mailbag sort of a last minute, a great idea, but we didn't solicit questions. So what our inbox is, sort of if we do a state of the inbox, is a lot of vibes. So this is going to be riding off of vibe checks, sort of energies, general feelings.
And we're not doing this because we couldn't book a guest this week, just to be clear.
No.
This was all really planned. not doing a vibe check because
so another reason I did want to do this is because we've actually added a lot of listeners during the pandemic. That was sort of a question of people aren't going to be commuting, you know, people's lives have been upended. Will people still be coming to podcasts? And what our inbox has said is like, yeah, absolutely. People were trapped inside and needed to get out and take walks, or trapped inside and just needed to escape with headphones on from whomever it is that they are quarantining with. And so we actually added a lot of people to our listenership during the pandemic. And a lot of people have written in saying that they discovered us because of one episode. And then, God bless them, binged our podcast.
Oh, God, you love it. You love to hear it.
I love to hear it. I have to say, if I'm going to shotgun a podcast in the times of the pandemic, I probably would have chosen a lighthearted comedic fare.
Totally, yes.
But so we've got some really strong-willed listeners.
I'm sort of amazed, like, I'm always amazed because, I mean, I love, like, this is one of my favorite things that we do as a podcast, and I love doing it because I feel like I learn a lot from it. I also feel like if I weren't doing this for a living, it is a podcast I probably almost certainly would listen to. That said, like, there are different podcasts I go to for different things. Like, I have to be in the sort of the right mindset for this kind of podcast, or like, mm-hmm. Kate, my wife, has a great legal podcast called Strict Scrutiny, which is awesome and really like smart and fun, entertaining, but like really like super sharp, like sharp discussion of legal issues where like, you got to kind of be locked in, you know, it's like one of those mm-hmm. podcasts where like, you'll do the 15-second back, be like, wait, what? And people say yes. that about our podcast all the time, which like I love. But then there's podcasts I listen to where it's like, it's just people just talking. And mm-hmm. and like that's its own kind of comforting ambient thing. So there's like different modes. If I'm on a walk yeah. or a drive where I'm like listening, that's the kind of podcast I listen to, which is mm-hmm. like the category I would probably put us in. Mm-hmm. But, and then if I'm like grilling or like making dinner or like doing a thing, a multitask, then there's others. But I'm really impressed by people that like have the attentional ability to kind of have us on in the background, I guess is yeah. what I'm saying. Because there definitely are people that do that. Although I also have heard from a lot of people that do like walking their dogs is a big one. And, you know, like going for walks is a big one. I like a good, real focused, like intellectually challenging podcast for a walk. Because that you can lock in.
Someone emailed in saying that they've been binging us while doing house renovations. And one, that's another pandemic hobby a lot of people yes. had. But also, I work on this show. I listen to it, the episodes, many times. And I am still a back 15-second person
yeah,
when
totally.
I'm trying to take something in. So this is what I'm saying about Vibe. We have a lot of ground that we've covered over the last year. And I'm curious about what you think the most emailed episode has been of, I would, let's say, the since 2021.
I mean, I have no idea what we've done. This is a thing that happens all the time on the show where we will literally be in the editorial meeting and one of us will be like, wait, what was the B block yesterday? And there's like a yeah. long 30-second pause and people scramble back through like, wait, what did we do yesterday? Because it's just, we do a lot of content. So you're yeah. asking what episode was the most emailed about? Like that yes. got the most, you know, one that comes to mind, and maybe I'm totally wrong, but we had that philosopher on who wrote that book, This Life, named Martin Haglund. Mm. I think that was his name. Mm-hmm. Which is a really profound and beautiful book about why, like, basically how you think about meaning and the meaning of this life in a philosophical tradition in which that you're, you know, there's no heaven and this is all we have. That one stuck with me for a really long time. Mm-hmm. So that one comes to mind, but what's the answer?
I'm going to let you in on a secret that we published that in November of 2019. A while ago.
Yeah. It's weird to me the resonance that those dates take on now, mm-hmm. like November 2019, it's like, oh yeah, it's already starting to creep its way across Hubei, mm-hmm. Hubei province at that point. Like
right. Someone somewhere out there. Well, of our most recent, you know, our last year or so episodes, the one that got the most response, partially because you did solicit it, and our editor Bryson sort of snickered at it when he heard your plug, was John McCorder, Who Gets to Say.
Oh, that's interesting. That makes sense because that was
from March.
That was, I think, that conversation about sort of speech censure, so-called cancel culture, wokeness, all these things has been so in the discourse and I think kind of maddening in a lot of ways. And I think that conversation, I enjoyed that conversation. I think there were probably parts of it that people also found like frustrating and maddening, got them emailing. But I'm curious what the yeah. tenor was.
So that's what's really fascinating is our inbox tends obviously to skew pretty progressive liberal, but this got pretty much equal responses on both sides. People who identified as liberal and said, thank you, like this has gone too far and we really needed a reality check on the situation. People who were liberal and said, this is absolutely incorrect and picking apart some of the arguments. And some people who identified as leaning more conservative, regular listeners of the show, who said that they were glad to hear a progressive podcast take this on and do it with the tenor that we had.
That's interesting.
Yeah. But what's interesting is this was in March, right? Obviously, cancel culture has been a constant. But this was before, largely, this entire critical race theory, cancel culture versus history sort of debate. And I wonder if since we've had that conversation in March and everything that we've been covering on the show All In, weeknights, 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 Central, you know, if there's anything that you have been thinking about in that field?
That's a great question. So here's how I would order my thoughts on this. One is that I think everybody draws a line between ideas to debate and ideas to denounce. That's a distinction that everyone draws. So there's just some things that people are not going to like debate. And like, there's anyone can come up with like an idea for a thing that, you know, I mean, the reason that we have Godwin's Law, which is this famous pronouncement by one of the internet's forefathers that, you know, any debate online and like message boards will eventually end up invoking the Nazis. And the reason for that is that the Nazis are an example of a kind of level of sort of evil and taboo, a line across which, you know, there's sort of a test of the extremes, right? They're so like in a philosophical sense, it's like a thought experiment, a real experiment from real history. And so that's the reason for it. And the point that to me makes is that we're having a lot of meta debates about what's in what bucket, like what's debatable and what mm-hmm. should be denounced. And the line between those moves over time. And in some ways, the movement of that line is both a product of social progress and good, but people aren't wrong to say like, wait a second, the line is moving. Like, it's like, yeah, it's true. Like certain things you could say that were in the like debate category got moved into the denounce category. But, you know, that's part of what social progress is. Now, all of that said, I also think that like sometimes I see people responding to ideas online with denunciation that I think are in the, like the debate category. And I think, you know, I think there's this conflation sometimes of speech and violence that I think can be really problematic. And you know, when people say certain kinds of speech is violence, I don't think it's like a ludicrous idea, but I also think it's a concept that could be really abused to turn debate into combat and to sort of invoke notions of sort of violence and physical safety in context that then end up shutting down debate. So like all of these kind of, I think these sort of discursively challenging and kind of illiberal impulses that are roiling through certain parts, I think particularly of the left when I'm talking about these ways. But the thing I think I would say about it is that like what we're seeing is that those impulses, these sort of anti-discourse, anti-speech impulses or impulses to use power to shut down conversations is like the idea that this is an issue of the left is ludicrous. And in fact, the people that seem most intent on wielding state power to do that now seem like conservative Republican state legislatures vis-a-vis this critical race theory moral panic, where they want to actually like legislate these sort of conversations and use state power to sort of coerce them. And then another great example is this, you know, brouhaha over Ben and Jerry's, which announced they won't be selling their ice cream in the occupied territories of the West Bank. Mm-hmm. That's resulted in conservatives saying, Senator Lankford of Oklahoma, tweeting that they should close the Ben and Jerry's shops in Oklahoma. Now, first of all, that's like obviously flat and unconstitutional. Second of all, that's like essentially authoritarian and crypto fascist. Third of all, it's not what the actual anti-BDS law of Oklahoma states, of course, because they did have lawyers who worked on that law, who understand that like that would obviously not fly. And it has to do with like penalties through government contracts with companies that boycott, right? So like, yes, the state of Oklahoma can cut off its contracts with Ben and Jerry's. And I think that's constitutionally acceptable, although in my view, dumb. But I guess like, again, all this stuff is like complicated and thorny. And in the discursive environments we often find ourselves in get reduced and very sloganeered. And I think, I guess the last thing I'll say is that like, and I've said this a few times on the podcast recently, and I think part of the reason that I find the podcast such a great bomb, BALM, is I like wrestling with complexity. I like thinking through things. I think a lot of things in life are pretty complicated. Again, even when things can be morally simple, this is a line that I've used multiple times down the podcast. And there is a kind of like exhausting sloganeering that happens in a lot of the realm of, I think, social media particularly, that even when I agree with the slogans, just it's just like a little discomforting, you know, mm-hmm. because it feels like it feels a kind of like a bludgeoning and a reductive impulse.
Yeah, that was something else some people have emailed in, is how much of these conversations that we have are things that are taking place online, and as extremely online people, as our jobs is of being like sort of on Twitter and where a lot of politicians are now and make major announcements, how much of that conversation, that flattening, that reduction of complex topics inherently happens online because it is a naturally flattening space. But then that is what is now transposed into conversation in the real world, that all of our conversation has been dictated by our brains adjusting to the flattening of these conversations on social media.
That is such a great and profound point, and I think is a huge thing that I'm wrestling with. In fact, I'm writing something on this right now, and in preparation, I'm reading two things that are both on this topic and both about forms of discourse and media prior to social media. So the first one is this classic book by Neil Postman called Amusing Ourselves to Death. It's a very like kind of curmudgeonly argument, but it's quite, I think, smart and persuasive, even in parts I don't agree with it, which there are lots, which basically says that like the migration from a print culture to a visual culture in the US like made our political discourse like much worse and much dumber. And actually, like, he makes a very strong argument, which is that like the forms of discourse actually provide forms of thinking, that like to what you just said, Tiffany, which is that mm-hmm. like the forms of discourse actually like create mental structures that then kind of like work up through our brains so that we think in the forms of the discourse. Mm-hmm. And he makes this argument that like basically the dawn of television and the move from a print culture to a visual culture basically made the whole country dumber. That's a oversimplification. but the very smart way that he goes through it is pretty persuasive. And then I just read this essay by George Saunders, reread an essay from 2007 called The Brain Dead Megaphone, which is great and short. You could read it in 15 minutes, in which he basically analogizes our current media environment. I think particularly he's talking about cable news, to like being at a party and everyone's talking and then one guy shows up with like a megaphone and just starts like yelling whatever dumb thing comes to his head, and how suddenly like everyone in the room is now listening to and or responding to the megaphone. And like you can't actually, like it ends up ruining the party because you can't have other conversations in the presence of the megaphone. Mm-hmm. And he basically is using the branded megaphone as a kind of metaphor for, I think, basically mostly broadcast and cable news in the run-up to the Iraq War. Mm. I think, so to extend that metaphor, like I do think the modes of discourse we engage in and the forms and platforms we engage in them in do structure our actual thinking about things. And I do worry that the specific modes of social media, which I think, you know, you and I mean, I'm extremely online to the point that it's like, you know, compulsive and sort of
what?
It's compulsive and like unnatural and like kind of bad. But my own addiction aside, like, you know, everyone is pretty, I mean, it's not just us, right? Like, mm-hmm. like yeah. You know, people are pretty embedded in social media. And I do wonder how it's affecting our thinking and how we think about things. The other thing I would say on the other side of that is that I also think it's very tempting to blame whatever technology is latest for problems that are like ancient and human. So it's like, oh my God, misinformation. People are spreading misinformation. It's like, yeah. Like, like, remember the witch burning that happened like back in the early days of the US? Right. Like, they didn't need Facebook. Like, yeah. Like, people, like, wild misinformation spreads through communities with horrible, deleterious effects that like riles up mobs into horrible action. That is a problem of human life that very much predates Facebook. And so, which is not to say like the algorithms aren't playing a role. It's not to say that. So I'm just trying to hold two ideas in my head. Like one is that I do think like the specifics of the platform or the given technology structure discourse. And by structuring discourse, they even go so far as to structure thought. At the same time, I'm also saying that like there are aspects of human behavior and the problems of being social humans who have incredible capacity both for like good and evil that gets morphed by our social circumstances and social structures that predates whatever the technology is. And often it is useful to blame the technology when things go awry.
Mm-hmm. So another one that we did that we weren't sure the reception of would be treating trans youth with Dr. Izzy Lowell.
Yes.
And I have to say the response to Dr. Lowell was extremely positive in our inbox.
I mean, how can you not love Dr.
Well, yes. Let me clarify. A phenomenal human being.
Clearly a phenomenal human being.
Just an absolute awe. But something that we talked about, that we talk about, you know, how we can cover these things on our show on All In and how we can cover them on the podcast is you're always trying to speak to people who you think you can invite in. And this was one of those conversations where people who would identify as, you know, progressive or inclusive will be unsure of this sort of this territory.
Yep.
And we had a really great response to it. And I'm curious about how you prepare for those types of interviews, for interviews where you are trying to represent or are, you know, in a population where you're unsure of it and trying to be as charitable to both sides that that conversation includes.
So that's an interesting question. I think there's a few things. One, so this is kind of a weird thing to admit, but I will admit it. At a technical level, I try not to prepare too much for those kinds of conversations. And the reason I don't is that I have within me a show-off demon. And sometimes what happens is that if I prepare too much, then the show-off demon wants to come out. And the show-off demon wants to show to the guest how much I know. this is not my favorite quality about myself, but I'm old enough and therapized enough to be self-aware of it. And obviously parts of the show-off demon are useful for my job, where I am kind of paid to show off at some level. So what I have found is that if I really bone up on a topic, that I've got all these ideas and thoughts in my head, and then I want to talk. And so if I keep myself more ignorant, that forces me to just ask questions. So that's one thing. Like I didn't do a ton of research into these questions on purpose with Dr. Lowell because I wanted her to answer them and I wanted to follow the natural thread of curiosity. You know, the other thing I would say is that the medium that we have where like we're having a conversation that's not live and can be edited, you can go in conversational dead ends and it's fine. Whereas if you're in a 4-5 minute live cable news segment and things flag, it's a little, you don't get that time back. Like people are watching it. So that also allows you to kind of like experiment a little bit with like what's the right level of assumed knowledge or ignorance to pitch this at conversationally. And then the final thing I will say about that conversation and some other conversations we had, this is true, I think, of like the one we did on the war in Yemen. It was true about the conversations we had about the Uyghurs. Like a thing that I encounter in my life and my consumption of news is sometimes an issue gets introduced through the prism of a political battle over it or a call to action about it. And you receive it first through that prism without actually knowing like the basic factual predicate underneath it.
Yeah. You have an opinion before you understand.
Yeah. So it's like Yemen. It's like this awful blockade is happening in Yemen and like stop the war in Yemen. And like, again, that's I think the correct position morally, but it's also like, whoa, back up for a second. What is going on in Yemen? Like who are the Houthis? Where did they come from? Does the US think they're being funded as Iranian proxies? What was the government beforehand? Like so I think that it's really useful. And I think one way I conceptualize one of the things that I think we do and with Pod, and I thought the Dr. Izzy Lowell conversation was just like, let's just put aside for a second, like the conversation, capital C, about trans youth and healthcare and the policy. Like, literally, what are we talking about? Like, a person comes to your clinic and they what? Yeah. Like, and I think there's a lot of times in the way that our discourse works that that stuff could just get skipped. Like, I even mm-hmm. like you can, you know, you're in the editorial meetings every day. Like, there's a lot of times where I will even say that in an editorial meeting where, like, we're talking about a thing that's like fighting about, and I'll just be like, wait a second. What mm-hmm. like what are the facts about this thing before we ascend to the level of like who's right and who's wrong, you know?
Yeah. So I also have a question for you about interview prep. I have some exciting updates on the podcast. And we're gonna get to all of that right after. See where I'm going with this?
I'm standing back in awe.
Right after we take this quick break. So that's how you prepare for interviews and trying to bring people into a new topic or to understand things from the ground up. Would you put John McWhorter, that conversation, in that same sort of vein?
Oh, that's interesting. No, that's a little bit of a different vein because that's a place where I want to like push and pull a little bit.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's how you plan to do interviews where you're trying to walk someone through something that's new territory, new ground. How do you prepare for a conversation that is more of a debate without making it into a contentious, you know, knockout brawl?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think, how do I do that? Well, I think mostly if we're doing a topic, it's one that I'm already pretty embedded in. So I have already, like in the John McWhorter example, like I already have a lot of thoughts that have been percolating in my head, and I'm extremely read into the latest developments in that conversation. So they're like, that was kind of, you know, I'm trying to have the conversation that I would have, you know, at a bar or a party with a person that I liked but disagreed with, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, people have different means of preparation. Like some people are real note takers, some people are not. Like I have always been lucky enough that I just retain a lot of things and remember a lot of things.
Ugh, so jealous. Your ability to just at your fingertips recall something that someone has said, I'm so unfair.
It's like a weird little, like, it's like kind of like a party trick. Like it's not correlated with any other talent or ability. It's just that I have always had the ability to just like instantly recall stuff that I read. Mm-hmm. Although, you know what's very weird? This is really fascinating. So Kate, my wife, is like a voracious, insanely voracious reader. And a voracious fiction writer and has been since she was like 5 years old.
Fiction? I didn't know that.
Yeah, Kate's like a voracious fiction reader, like loves fiction, reads fiction all the time, always has a book, like always going through. She's a member of two different book clubs. and I am a pretty voracious nonfiction reader and don't read that much fiction. My recall for nonfiction books is like really high. Like I just remember facts and dates and quotes and things people said. I cannot remember anything from any novel I've ever read. Like, it is so freaking weird. It is a complete black hole. And Kate, who has great retention for nonfiction also, but like, Kate remembers like plots of books, characters, like this character dated that character. Remember when? And I'm just like, a thing that I read like literally 2 months ago, I'm just like blank stare, nothing. Yeah. Like, they were in Italy. I remember that part of it. Like, it's so weird. It's like, it's.
That's your summary of an Elena Ferrante book.
Yes, exactly. That's my summary of Elena Ferrante.
They're in Italy. They're
girls in Italy, I think. A lot of people being mean. But anyway, so I, for preparation, this comes back to preparation, which, you know, mm-hmm. I read a lot. I read all day. I also have a lot of avenues. There's people that I like text with, DM with, like there are people that I'm constantly in like some conversation with about these things too. So I'm also kind of like discursively engaged around a lot of these topics. And so when it comes time to like do a John McWhorter podcast, it's like, I've just thought a lot about that specific issue. And so it's a kind of like let her rip situation.
Well, something I personally found as someone who works with you and who works on this podcast is a part of the interview you did with Anna Deavere Smith earlier this year, Finding Truth in Doubt. Mm-hmm. And she is a prolific interviewer. That is how she creates these amazing shows, these amazing one-woman shows that she puts on, is just conducting hundreds of interviews, and the craft that goes into it and the patience and the planning, like it isn't a conversation. It is labor.
Yeah.
And that back and forth that you had with her, I thought was really interesting. And as someone who people come to the show for your ability to have these types of laid back interviews and conversations that still are able to get to the heart of something is difficult. And I think people can take for granted how difficult it is to navigate an interview.
Yeah. And I think it's definitely a skill, and it's one you build up over time. And like, I mean, I feel like interviews on the show and cable news are, they're way higher difficulty just because they're live and they're shorter. There's less room for error. And frankly, I feel like with those interviews, I feel a little bit like a baseball hitter, sometimes they're good and sometimes they're not what I would have wanted. And a lot of time that's on me. Like, I boot stuff for sure all the time on the show. Just a nature of the same way good baseball hitters strike out. Like, it's just, we're doing it a lot. There's different situations, sometimes technical issues, whatever. But the one thing that I will say, you know, the key skill, I think, for good journalism and good interviewing is listening. And a thing that I really like about journalism that I think has been good for me as a person is that it's really made me a much better listener than I think I would have otherwise been, because I'm very clearly someone who likes to talk and likes to hear myself talk. Again, not like my favorite quality about myself, but I remember early on first being a reporter and interviewing people. I think I might have even said this on the podcast before, but like, interviewing people and having this kind of amazing feeling of this burden being lifted from my shoulders that I didn't have to do anything. I didn't have to correct them. I didn't have to argue with them if I disagreed. I didn't have to impress them. I didn't have to charm them or make them laugh. Like, all I had to do was listen to what they had to say and then ask more questions to get them to talk more. And I find that like a relief and very enjoyable. And like, when you talk about the Izzy Lowell podcast, like, I love that podcast, both in what the podcast was, but just in the moment I loved it, because it gave me that pleasurable sensation that I still get doing reporting or interviewing that I first got as a 22-year-old, you know, with a pad and pencil of like, the part of me that feels the need to perform for people that's kind of compulsive and also like maybe a little needy and also like is activating my adrenal system. Like, for that to kind of shut down in that period is a very pleasurable experience.
So the end of another episode you solicited feedback was Dr. Peter Hotez, which was about the vaccines before they were largely available to the majority. Like, this was end of March, early April, I think. And you asked how people's vaccine process was going. And for the majority of people, wonderfully, it was smooth. People reached out across the U.S. and like around the world. And people had a really positive experience, like very affirming in the infrastructure that they were able to go and, you know, have this experience with their community and this like turning point. But there were a lot of people who were still struggling through conversations with loved ones who were vaccine hesitant for XYZ reasons, but none of them medical. They were, you know, a block of conspiracy or fear about the development of the vaccine. And someone asked if you had had to have that type of conversation with someone that you love. These are conversations that we have on All In, and we talked about it at length with Dr. Hotez. But if that's something that you've had to do in your own life.
So I have not had anyone. I have had people who were, I thought, not prioritizing getting it as fast as I thought they should have. But I have not had anyone close to me who is like, I really don't want to get it, or I think it's, they developed it too fast, or, you know, all of those things. Now, I would say that, like, partly I think a little bit of like the life world of pandemic life is shrunk a little bit. So I'm just having less interactions with people and less casual conversations with folks than I normally would in my normal life, I think. But, you know, I'm very aware that like my family, social circle, life world is like not representative of anything. But no, I have to be totally honest and say there are people that I felt like were dragging their feet and gave little kind of nudges to, like, you should really just schedule it in that kind of way you do with someone who's like putting something off, but not the, no, I've heard it's bad for X, Y, and Z. I really have not had those conversations.
That's good. I'm happy to hear that.
How about you?
I do have people that are in my family who are not going to get the vaccine for a lot of the reasons that we cover on the show. Political reasons, the downplaying of it, thinking it's not that bad. Largely, everybody is vaccinated and healthy, but I think it in my family falls down political divides for sure.
Yeah, I was just talking to a friend who has had this with her family members, some of her family members, and she was just saying, like, I just have no interest and no ability to feel like I can. Like, she's like, first of all, I love these people and I want to keep feeling positive and loving about them. And like, we already have things that we don't see eye to eye on and disagree about that we just kind of agree to put aside. And I just don't feel like I have the ability to persuade them. And I was like, yeah, I think everyone's got to make judgments for themselves about those relationships and what conversations are and aren't going to be productive. And I think, you know, one of the things I think is possibility, and I think is probably playing out a little bit, is, you know, there is a little like, you know how you get that like spidey sense if someone comes up to you on the street and you can tell they're trying to sell you something, where you're like, it's a very New York specific thing too. Of like, hey man, how you doing today? And you're like, okay, wait,
no, thanks.
What? You're not saying, hey man, how are you doing today? Because you want to know how I am doing today.
Yeah.
You want to sell me something. And I do think that there can be a kind of a little bit of a back, you know, there's a kind of resistance, autonomy resistance that happens from feeling like you're being sold something that I think, I'm sure there's research on this, I don't know it, like that, you know, engaging in those conversations necessarily helps that. But I know that it's a thing, it's so many people that I've heard from dealing with this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think, really hard because it's funny. There are lots of things that I can, if I work to like subjectively access, understand where people are coming from. I felt that way about a lot of the resistance to like lockdown and mask wearing and that stuff. Like that did not seem inscrutable to me or strange. Like I 100% got it. In the end, I was, you know, thought that those policies were really important because I think the benefits way outweigh the cost. But I got this one, I have a harder time with, I have to say. Like, it's like, it's much harder for me to put myself in the mindset of wanting to not, of resisting the vaccine than say, not wanting to wear a mask or thinking it's ridiculous that we, you know, can't get in elevators together and things like that. It's just a harder one for me to psychologically access.
Well, I think it fits into something that Dr. Hotez talks about, is that there is already an existing ecosystem, a machine built of anti-vax messaging, propaganda, and, you know, those are all well-worn paths that people could easily walk down.
Yes, and here's another aspect to it, and we didn't talk about this with Hotez, and I kind of was regretting that we didn't because I was having this conversation. So the way most vaccination works in the country, and I know this firsthand because I'm the father of three children ages, you know, 3, 7, and 9, is that like your kids get a ton of shots and, you know, it's a whole big thing. There's like a yellow card. There's a vaccine schedule. You take them in. There's, you know, they get certain shots at the 6 month and the year and then at 2, like they're constantly getting shots. It's a big part of like the experience of going to the pediatrician when you got a little kid, particularly because like, you know, it's sad when your 6 month old gets jabbed in the thigh and wails until the breath doesn't come out of their mouth, which is what tends to happen. And, but then it's like, then that's done. And the only kind of vaccine you really get as an adult, there's HPV, which you get, you know, as a teenager, but really it's the flu vaccine. That's like the big shot you get as an adult. And there's lots of people who don't take the flu shot. Lots. Even though I late in life became convinced that like it's really important to take the flu shot, and I now get a flu shot every year. But I do think the part of the weirdness of the resistance is that we're asking adults to go get a needle stuck in them, which is not the way that most vaccines are administered. Most vaccines get administered without any actual autonomy as required by, you know, school entries that require like opt-outs to children who then forget about it, basically. So it is a weird thing that like mass vaccination of adults is a somewhat novel undertaking.
All right, let's close this bad boy out with some updates. Exciting changes on the WithPod front. We've talked, I think, a few times, maybe dropped a couple of hints that this is a very small enterprise, a very tight team that makes this happen every week. When we launched it, it was just a side project, and it was something that we would go and record for an hour. We would have our editor would turn it around, and then that would be it, basically. Since then, because so many people find value in it and listen to it, which we're so thankful for, it has become much bigger than what just our tiny little team is able to do in our free time. We've done live tours. We've done, you know, live shows. The marketing for it, promos, we want to be able to do a lot more. And that just expands beyond the scope that I could do and Chris could do and our spare seconds. So we have hired...
Dun, da, da.
So exciting that we have hired a full-time producer. And this show is going to be his job from soup to nut. Have you heard this phrase, soup to nuts, Chris?
It's yeah.
Okay. I said it to someone and they looked at me like
a little boomery. I think it's like an old school phrase. But yes, soup to nuts.
All right. Well, I'm an old school person. So they are going to be his name is Donnie. He's going to be starting very soon, and he is going to take over the daily production of the podcast and, you know, what we can do, how we can expand, where we can go from here. We have some ideas or things that we're excited about. Some people have emailed about live shows, that a lot of things that have to be figured out, but we loved doing those. So in our ability to do them at some point in the future, we would love to revisit that. But if there are things that you, besides just topics, but things that you would love to see, ideas for where the podcast could go, we would love to hear from you, because right now is an exciting time of change and growth and expansion. And so if you have any thoughts, hit me up on that Gmail, withpod@gmail.com. I'm always checking that inbox. If I'm not replying, it's because once I start replying, I will do that for 4 hours.
Well, and one of the things I have to say, as with committed WithPod listeners know, that the show can't happen without the one and only Tiffany Champion, who does also have a, I was going to say day job, but it's actually kind of a night job, which is being the line producer for All In, which is a very, very difficult job, one of the more demanding jobs that exist in cable news, because she is the person that manages the show moment by moment down to the seconds, like how long the show is going to be. It has to time out the same time every night, and then live in the moment is managing it and dynamically figuring out where to cut, how to move things around so that we always hit the mark. It's a really, really, really demanding job. I mean, the sort of three most demanding jobs during the actual show are the director, who's sitting in a control room, actually calling out the shots that you're seeing, like what anytime there's B-roll, any element that comes up, when I throw to a piece of sound, like he's dynamically doing that. There's the line producer who's managing the second by second tick through of the show, which is Tiffany. And then there's me who's doing, you know, hosting the show. And the three of us are the people that are most kind of like, you know, dynamically surfing the time, the wave of time that is live television. So Tiffany has an incredibly demanding and difficult job every day, and this show would not happen without her incredible, indispensable talent. So huge thanks to Tiffany for taking that on. But we're both very happy that Donnie's going to come on board. And the other thing I would say is, when I talk to him, one of the things that I really want to do is like just build out a little bit the WithPod community, because I feel like there are people who are really invested in the show that I would like to be able to interact with more. And maybe that means like doing more mailbags. Maybe that means Q&As online, or that might mean like starting up a newsletter. But all of that stuff is some of the stuff I want to develop around the show and, you know, follow up. Some people have questions, we have guests, and finding ways to sort of keep those sort of questions and the kind of intellectual life of the show going in between episodes. So we've got big plans there, and we haven't really been able to do them on that front because of how overextended we are.
Yeah, it's hard. I'm excited. It's also hard because these are all things that I wish I could have been able to do. You know, like I've seen where we could grow and where we could expand, and it's
yeah, totally.
Parting is sweet sorrow, but I'm.
Well, you're not. I mean, you're not going anywhere.
I'm not.
Like, well, yeah. You can still do mailbags. All right. Do you want to do, since you did the throw, do you want to do the, do you want to do
yeah,
the tag?
Sure. Let me pull up the cheat sheet. I wonder if I can do it by heart. Why Is This Happening is presented by MSNBC and NBC News and produced by the All In team. Features music by Eddie Cooper. You can see more of our work, including links to things that we mentioned here, by going to nbcnews.com/whyisthishappening.
Nailed it.